as well as resilience, grit, and determination from the inside for yourself. It's interesting to think about these topics in terms of who needs them the most. I've found, as someone who's presented this material for many years now, that it's easy to reduce it to something as simple and in a way trivial as, well, smell the flowers along the way. And I want to be clear here, I'm talking about something that is the foundation of self-reliance, the foundation of personal autonomy as we deal with the world around us. The harder a person's life, the more that that person is challenged, the more that that person's living in settings that have many vulnerabilities, the less that that person is being supported by the outer world, including that person's relationships, the more important it is for that person to look for opportunities to have beneficial experiences of various kinds in the flow of daily life. And then, critically important, and I'll talk about how to do this, help those experiences land inside as the seeds, which then grow over time inside the person's nervous system, of a fundamentally resilient well-being. As a framing comment here, I want to talk about three ways to engage the mind, because as I focus here on one of those three ways, I want to put it in context. My own background includes many years of mindfulness training. I started meditating in 1974. I'm also a clinical psychologist. I'm grounded in those methods. I've also been involved in the human potential movement, self-help territory, and I've been a parent and educator, and I've worked in business. When I think back on all the methods, all the useful ideas and tools for engaging our feelings, our sensations, our desires, our mind all together, I think they fall into three basic categories. The first category is simply to be with what's there. Feel the feelings. Experience the experience. Do so usefully. Stepping back from the movie to witness it, 20 rows back, eating some popcorn. Whoa, that looks horrible. But still experiencing whatever there is to experience. Hopefully there are other things happening as well as we be with what's there, such as self-compassion or self-acceptance, curiosity, investigation. Sometimes it's helpful to investigate what is more fundamental or soft or vulnerable underneath the surface, such as the hurt that often lies beneath anger. As we be with what's there, it might change, but we're not making deliberate efforts in our minds to nudge it one way or another. I think this way of relating to the mind is fundamental. It's often the last resort because that's all we can do. All we can do is just ride out the storm, hopefully not making things worse. And also as practice matures, as people develop over their lifespan, more and more they often find themselves simply being with the moment, hanging out, present at the front edge of now, continuously letting go. But this is not the only way to practice with the mind. And I think in some quarters it's become overvalued, that the only way to relate to the mind is in a kind of choiceless awareness, a sort of inert witnessing of the streaming of consciousness. It's also very important, in addition to being with the mind, to work with the mind. And there are two aspects of working with the mind, in which we prevent or release or decrease what is negative, what is painful or harmful for ourselves and other people, and we encourage, protect, or create that which is positive, that which is beneficial for ourselves and other people. So, for example, in that second way to engage the mind, reducing or preventing or abandoning the negative, you might let go of tension in your body, or vent feelings, or listen to some of these thoughts that make you crazy or make other people crazy, and disengage from them, you know, let them go. Or maybe release or decrease or even abandon problematic desires. Those are natural and important forms of letting go. And then, of course, it's important to let in, to grow inner fortitude, inner strength, determination, skillfulness, compassion for others, empathy for others, compassion for yourself, the kind of inner resources that I'm going to focus on here. All three of these are important. All three of them work together. For example, to simply be with the mind, it's necessary to grow resources inside so we can tolerate sometimes what we're being with. Otherwise, opening to experience can sometimes feel like opening a trapdoor to hell. So we need to develop resources such as steadiness of mind, or as psychologists call it, distress tolerance, being able to manage our feelings without being flooded by them. So by growing the resource, we are more able to be with the mind. Alternately, we draw upon being with the mind to let go, because we need to be with the results and see what they turn out to be. All three of these work together. So if you were to think of your mind as kind of like a garden, a simple metaphor here is we can witness it, we can pull weeds, and we can plant flowers. I'm going to focus on the planting flowers in the garden of the mind and therefore the brain, but it's in this larger context. The second point I like to make about all this as a frame is that mindfulness is to be present in all three ways to relate to the mind. There's a misunderstanding that's developed that mindfulness means only a passive witnessing of the stream of consciousness, so that any form of wise effort with the mind is somehow at odds with or in conflict with mindfulness, as if, and I've heard people say sometimes, oh, that's not mindfulness. I say, oh, that's not a correct understanding of mindfulness, because mindfulness is to be present while we're walking, while we're talking with our teenager, while we're trying to get a toddler into a car seat, one of the most stressful things known to humankind. Mindfulness is to be present as we have opportunities for gratitude or awe or self-compassion, and we take these experiences into ourselves. So mindfulness is to be present in all three ways to engage the mind. I'm going to focus here, as I said, on the third of these, cultivating the beneficial, but it's in this larger context. So with that as a context then, I want to talk about something really interesting, which is that as the focus has emerged in positive psychology these days on character strengths and other forms of resourcing oneself, there's been a lot of attention on identifying key resources inside yourself and using them. Well, that's great. But what about growing them in the first place? What about acquiring them? Where do they come from? And how can we get more of them? It's interesting that roughly a third of the variation in human attributes, psychological characteristics, including inner resources, is based on heritable factors, essentially woven into our DNA, innate. The other two-thirds, on average, of the variation in human attributes, including our resources, are based on what is acquired as a result of the way the world treats us and what we do about it and how we engage our own minds. This two-thirds, fundamentally, is under human influence, which is both hopeful and takes us to a fundamental kind of responsibility. And to bottom line all this, if we are to have influence ourselves over this fundamental process of development, of healing, of change for the better, that means we have to engage the brain. Because if we're going to develop anything that lasts, that requires some kind of physical change in the body, particularly in its nervous system, whose headquarters is the brain. The fundamental requirement here, then, is how do we change the brain for the better? And that's what I want to talk with you about now. So to change the brain for the better involves many different kinds of methods. And before I dive into them, I want to sort of level with you here and give you an overview of the current research on this topic. First of all, there's great evidence that mental practices of various kinds in human beings, such as mindfulness training, produce lasting benefits psychologically, presumably via some kind of change in the brain. In effect, mental practice A, through something changing in the black box of the brain B, produces mental result C, such as greater trait mindfulness. There's tremendous evidence for that. Second, in studies that are invasive, acknowledging and then moving on from the ethical considerations here, invasive studies of non-human animals have shown again and again and again, including down at the cellular, even molecular level, that the apparent experiences that the cat, the rat, the monkey is having are leading to lasting physical changes in their nervous systems. There's a great deal of evidence for that. There's some evidence that psychological practices of various kinds, including meditation, mindfulness training, or other forms of psychological interventions, can leave lasting changes in the brain. For example, common research findings include the fact that as people routinely practice mindfulness, especially in the formal setting of meditation, and they do that as the years go by, even over actually shorter periods of time, like 8 weeks, there can be measurable lasting changes in the brain as a result, such as a thickening of cortex in the front part of the brain behind the forehead that's involved in executive control, or changes elsewhere in the brain. There's some evidence for this. But since neuroscience is a baby science, and since our technology is still quite rudimentary, the evidence here is partial. But it's already suggesting that our mental practices of various kinds can leave lasting changes in our brain. There is only a little bit of evidence scattered in various kinds of studies, including on non-human animals, that there are internal deliberate things that people can do, learning factors that could be described broadly, such as extending the duration of an experience or intensifying it for oneself or focusing on what is personally meaningful about it. There's a little bit of evidence that the engagement of those learning factors, which is what I'm going to focus on here, can produce a lasting change in the brain. So I want to be honest with you and humble about what is currently known. It's really interesting that even as so many people are involved in, broadly defined, the growth business, there's very little of a general theory of growth applied to social emotional learning, and very, very little focus on what people can do from the inside out to steepen their growth curve. I think that's a missing opportunity. And I really hope that more research is being done in this area. That said, in the deeply scientific saying, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And particularly if the risks or costs of an intervention are relatively low, such, for example, you in this program trying inside your mind some of the methods I'm describing to you, if something is plausible, and what I'm saying here is certainly plausible, it can be useful to run the experiment, run a little experiment inside the laboratory of your own mind, which means inside the laboratory of your own brain, and see what the internal evidence is for you. So continuing here then, if you just kind of imagine the brain, it's quite an extraordinary organ. It looks like rotten cauliflower kind of from the outside. It's judged actually by scientists, even though it's very modest looking, to be arguably the most complex physical object currently known to humankind. It contains roughly 1.1 trillion cells, about 100 billion of which are neurons. We have as many neurons in our head as there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. A typical neuron is making several thousand connections with other neurons, little connections called synapses, giving us, and each one of them is like a little microprocessor, an internal network of several hundred trillion microprocessors sparkling away even as I speak with you here and even as you listen to this or watch it along the way. Wow. Typical neuron is firing 5 to 50 times a second. Large-scale patterns of synchronized activity sweep through the brain many times a second. Over the course of a single minute, quadrillions of synaptic events have occurred right between our ears. Wow. So how can we help this amazing organ be as effective as possible to help us deal with our day or our life and grow things inside that we can draw upon for other people? Now I would like to talk with you about the fundamental process of what Jeffrey Schwartz at UCLA has called self-directed neuroplasticity. How can the brain change for the better? And in the process of it changing for the better, how can we change for the better and become happier and stronger, wiser and more loving along the way? The fundamental neuropsychology of learning has two necessary and sufficient stages. And by the way, when I talk about learning, I'm using that term broadly, like psychologists do, to include emotional learning, somatic learning, social learning, attitudinal learning, motivational learning, even spiritual learning. Really, compared to the multiplication tables, probably the kind of learning that we care about actually the most. So in terms of this process of development, which includes healing, another form of learning, it occurs in two necessary stages. The first stage is to have the experience. There's a little bit of learning that occurs through unconscious processes, but most of the processes of helping ourselves heal and grow and strengthen occurs through conscious experiences. We don't yet have the kind of technology that they had in the movie The Matrix, and frankly, I hope we never do, in which we could jack a cable into the back of the head and transfer the file and suddenly somebody knows how to fly a helicopter. We don't have that. We need to begin with the experience, such as an experience of mindfulness or an experience of gratitude or an experience of self-worth. That's where we start. But for there to be any kind of lasting change for the better, besides a passing experience, by definition, there must be a physical change as a result. Otherwise, the experience might be pleasant in the moment, might be useful in the moment, but it, by definition, leaves no lasting value behind. There are different ways of talking about these two stages. One way I think of it, frankly, is you get the song playing in the inner iPod, or because I'm older, I might think about the inner jukebox. You get that song playing. And then, critically important, in the second stage, turn on the inner recorder. There are different ways of talking about these stages. In neurological language, we would speak of encoding and then consolidation, or I might say more broadly, activation, installation, or really, really simply, the movement from state to trait. And I'm using the term trait here a little more broadly than is sometimes used to describe any kind of lasting or durable personal characteristic. This process of change, this two-stage process, is well summarized these days in a saying from the work of the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together, wire together. It's a two-stage process here. Now, actually, that process of change occurs through mechanisms deep down in the hardware of the brain that go well beyond simply wiring together. There are a variety of mechanisms of what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity, neuroplasticity that depends upon the experiences we're having. Existing synapses can become stronger or weaker as a result of our experiences. New connections do form. That's the wiring together. There are also changes in ebbs and flows of neurochemicals inside the brain based on the experiences we're having that produce lasting changes inside, such as changes of neurotransmitters like dopamine or serotonin or oxytocin. Another mechanism of lasting change involves literally changes in the expression of genes, tiny little strips of atoms inside the twisted up molecules of DNA and the chromosomes in the nuclei of individual neurons. These are epigenetic changes. There are other mechanisms of change as well. I'll spare you a lot of the details. What's exciting is that with modern science, we're now understanding what was known over a century ago, that something had to change in the brain. The basic idea of neuroplasticity is not breaking news, but what is breaking news is the depth and variety and rapidity, the speed of the various mechanisms that can be used to change the brain for the better. Experientially, this translates to, if we want to become more compassionate, we need to experience compassion and then internalize it. If we want to be more mindful, we need to have experiences of mindfulness that we receive inside, that sink in some way, that increase trait mindfulness over time. Similarly, if we want to be more determined, more committed to exercise, more committed to sobriety, more committed to social justice, we need to have experiences of determination or related factors that are in the second necessary stage internalized. The takeaway here for me as a longtime psychologist, parent, educator, and so forth is actually a really humbling one. Experiences in the moment can be useful. They can be enjoyable. But do they leave any lasting value? Do we gain from them in any way? Is there any kind of healing, growth, or development, or acquisition of inner strengths, inner resources? And it's, for me, humbling, even haunting to appreciate that most of the experiences that people have, even hard-won, well-earned experiences, leave no lasting traces behind. They wash through the brain like water through a sieve. And it's remarkable to appreciate that we have this phenomenal opportunity right under our noses to get better at helping the experiences that we're having leave some kind of lasting value inside us, hardwired into our nervous system. And of course, I'm going to be talking with you about how to do this. And this general point about the low conversion rate from experiences we're having into any kind of lasting change is sharpened when you consider what scientists call the brain's evolved negativity bias. I think of it as we have a brain like Velcro for bad experiences, but Teflon for good ones. And that's because as we evolved, as our ancestors evolved over the 600 million year evolutionary timescale of the human nervous system, it was really important to do two things. To kind of simplify it, to get carrots, like food or mating opportunities, but avoid sticks, like predators or natural hazards, or aggression between bands or inside bands. Both are important, carrots and sticks, but there's a fundamental difference in the wild. If you fail to get a carrot today, you'll probably have a chance at one tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid that stick today, whack, no more carrots forever. As a result, we have a brain that's designed to do five things. It's hardwired into it. First, we tend to scan for bad news. Out in the world, in the body, in the mind, what could go wrong? What's coming around the horizon? What do I need to deal with? Second, as soon as we find that one tile in the mosaic of reality that's blinking red, whoosh, the brain zooms in and hyper-focuses upon it. That's one reason why in Barbara Fredrickson's wonderful theory of the effects of positive emotions, it's described as broaden and build. Because as we're experiencing emotionally positive things, our field of awareness and perceptual field tends to widen. On the other hand, as we become more anxious, more irritated, more frustrated, our attention tends to close down on that one tile, as I said, in the mosaic of our experience that's flashing red. The third thing that happens by design is that we overreact to the negative. People react more to pain than to pleasure. People will react more to losing something than to gaining the same thing. That's the basis for Daniel Kahneman, the psychologist, Nobel Prize in economics, for what's called loss aversion or prospect theory. Another example of this overreaction to things is that we are much more affected by negative experiences with other people than we are by positive ones. Negative interactions in a relationship have much more impact than positive ones and they therefore to be offset by a lot of positive interactions. When I came across that finding in grad school, I immediately rewound the tape of the last 2 days with my wife and thought, I need to raise my game. And then the brain has this fourth fundamental characteristic as an aspect of the negativity bias in which it fast-tracks the experience into memory, especially emotional memory, somatic memory, body memory, once burned, twice shy. For example, we are very affected. We're designed to be affected quickly by experiences of helplessness, defeat, and entrapment, futility, and very rapidly acquire what's called learned helplessness. And it takes many times as many as counter experiences to acquire over time what's called learned optimism. The fifth evolved feature of the negativity bias, hardwired into the brain, thanks, Mother Nature, is the ways in which our painful, irritating, frustrating, stressful experiences sensitize us to negative experiences. And that happens with the hormone cortisol. It is released when we are feeling pressured or irritated or driving. It's certainly released in moderate to severe, even traumatic, stressful conditions. And cortisol, as it's released, goes up into the brain where it has a kind of 1-2 punch. The first thing it does is that it sensitizes the alarm bell of the brain, the amygdala, these two little regions about the size of almonds in the center of the brain that are like threat detectors. So now the threat detector is a little more on a hair trigger and it's going to ring a little more loudly. The second thing that cortisol does in the brain is that it overstimulates and eventually kills neurons in and gradually weakens a nearby part of the brain called the hippocampus, a little seahorse-shaped region in the brain, which is the basis of its name, that's close to the amygdala. And this is important because the hippocampus helps us in three ways. First, it puts things in context. This is now, that was then. Second, the hippocampus inhibits, it calms down the alarm bell, the amygdala. And the third thing that the hippocampus does for us is that it signals another nearby and really important part of the brain, the hypothalamus, that there are enough stress hormones already. No more. Well, this creates a vicious cycle. As we sensitize the alarm bell, and weaken the regulation of it, we become just a little more vulnerable to stress tomorrow based on the stressful experiences we have today. And as we become a little more vulnerable tomorrow to exasperation, anxiety, hurt, drivenness, as we become a little more vulnerable to that tomorrow, that releases just a little more cortisol, which makes us even more vulnerable the day after in a vicious cycle. And it's important to appreciate that these are deliberate. These are useful for ancestors living in Jurassic Park or back in the Stone Age on the Serengeti Plains. But today, these hardwired tendencies in us create a lot of unnecessary suffering under most conditions, a lot of unnecessary worry, unnecessary self-criticism, and unnecessary conflicts with others. Because as the negativity bias wears on us, it has a sixth feature, which is that we tend to get involved in vicious cycles with other people. As we become more negative ourselves, the world tends to treat us more negatively, which confirms our expectations, and round and round and round we go. In effect, the negativity bias functions as a kind of universal, well-intended learning disability. In effect, the negativity bias is like a bottleneck in the brain. It allows negative experiences to go right in, fast-tracked for storage and for usage and influence later. And meanwhile, most of our beneficial experiences sort of just bounce right off. And that's why it's so important to help ourselves a handful of times every day, and maybe in particular with key experiences we want to internalize, it's so important to help ourselves get the benefit from the useful experiences we're having, not to cling to them, not to crave them. In fact, actually, as we fill ourselves up increasingly over time, we become less hungry. We become less driven to grab for the next shiny object down the road. And in my next talk, I'll tell you how to do this step by step, grounded in the science of positive neuroplasticity and in the flow of everyday life.
Lecture 4, Hardwiring Inner Resources, Heal.
So now let's explore how to have lasting gains from passing experiences. In effect, how can we increase the conversion rate, the return on investment from the experiences we're having, the beneficial states, how can we increase their conversion rate into beneficial traits? And to frame this topic, I'd like to share with you a story that I heard in a particular frame. You may have heard this story as well. Essentially, the way I heard it was that a woman was asked toward the end of her life, "Grandmother, how did you become so happy? What did you do? How did you become so strong, so capable, so effective? What did you do? How did you become so wise? How did you become so loved? What did you do? How did you do it?" She paused, she reflected, and then she said, "You know, when I was young like you, I realized that in my heart were two wolves, one of love and one of hate. And I realized that everything depended upon which one I fed each day." That's a profound teaching story. It speaks, of course, to the presence metaphorically of the wolf of hate in most beings, certainly myself, the capacity of an inclination toward resentment, envy, aggression, even violence and war. If we hate the wolf of hate, we just feed the wolf of hate. And what the story speaks to in its second aspect is the vital importance of the one we feed. Do we feed the wolf of hate or the wolf of love? Do we feed the wolf of self-criticism that's destructive and tears us down? Do we feed the wolf of needless worry, anxious rumination, getting involved in our case against other people that's resentful and aggrieved? Do we feed those tendencies in us? And in the process of feeding them, since neurons that fire together, wire together, stimulate and therefore strengthen the neural substrates of those unhelpful, unskillful, even unwholesome states of mind? Or alternately, do we feed the wolf of love, or the wolf of mindfulness, or gratitude, or grit, or motivation or happiness altogether. That's our opportunity day after day as we make those choices to withdraw food from the problematic tendencies in us or the inclinations of our own mind and heart, and instead feed that which is helpful, that which is happy and wholesome and beneficial for ourselves and often for others as well. So now I'd like to talk with you about how to actually do that in your own brain. And I'm going to use a framework that I've developed, summarized in the acronym HEAL, H-E-A-L. It speaks to the fundamental process of self-directed neuroplasticity, including the necessary and sufficient two stages in this process. To begin with, we first must have a beneficial experience. Like I said, we can't just jack a cable into the back of the head and suddenly become more confident. We need to begin with some kind of an experience. Usually it's an experience we're already having, and all we need to do is notice it. There we are, moving through our day. There's a moment of friendliness with the hot dog vendor. There's a moment of relief that things turned out well. There's a moment of connection with another person, maybe a sense of accomplishment that we got something done. Or maybe there's a sense of our own good intentions or our own durability, our own capacity to endure and keep on going. Whatever it might be, the song is already playing, as it were, in the inner iPod. Why not turn on the recorder? Notice it, and then take it into ourselves. The other way to have a beneficial experience is to deliberately create it, such as calling up things that we're thankful for to help ourselves have an experience of gratitude. Or in my case, as a longtime rock climber, calling up the body memory of pulling over an overhang to have a sense of strength when I have to really deal with someone who's coming at me. There's a place for creating experiences. Sometimes people think that that's overly manipulative. I say, so what? Our mind, our brains are being manipulated all day long by other people, forces of media, including alarm bells that are ringing out there in the world, and we're being manipulated by the reactions arising inside ourselves. So why not manipulate ourselves skillfully? And as a lot of research shows, the capacity to self-generate, self-activate useful states of being, useful thoughts, useful sensations in the body, useful emotions, useful intentions and desires is very fundamental to coping and to everyday resilience. All right, now we have that beneficial experience. It's happening. How can we take it in? How can we internalize it? I think internalization has two fundamentally distinct aspects, subjectively and objectively. I call them enriching and absorbing. The enriching aspect, subjectively, is a sense of the experience being big, intense, lasting in the mind. The song is playing loudly. Absorbing, subjectively, feels like really receiving it into oneself, making room for it in oneself, giving over to it experientially, maybe with a sense, even literally, of something sinking in like water into a sponge, or light moving inside into shadows, or a kind of soothing balm coming down into oneself. That's the experience of absorbing. Objectively, in terms of what's happening in the neurology, enriching essentially is a matter of a sustained, intense, pervading pattern of neural activation, and absorbing, objectively, is a matter of sensitizing, priming, and making more efficient the memory-making machinery of the nervous system. It's an effect like helping the recorder be better at registering the music that's playing in your mind. So just to talk about each one of them in particular, enriching is kind of a matter of popping open the bottleneck in the brain to help the good experiences, maybe metaphorically described as green balls, to really come on in. And there are five different ways you can help yourself enrich your experiences so that the installation of them in your nervous system is increased. You don't need to do all these five techniques. Just one of them is fine. But I like to know that there are different things I can do. If you think about it, a lot of the essence of what I'm talking about here is self-reliance and resourcefulness. So it's nice to know resourcefully that there are multiple things we can do inside our own mind authentically to help learning land inside us, in the broadest sense of that word, learning. So the first way to enrich an experience is to keep it going. Keep that song playing. Keep those neurons firing together so they have a chance to wire together. A second way to increase the enrichment of an experience is to intensify the experience. Turn up the music. Help it pervade your mind, even if it's a fairly subtle experience like awe or tranquility. Sometimes gratitude can feel fairly subtle. But if it's all that fills your mind, it's effectively intense. A third aspect of enriching, as every kindergarten teacher knows, is to help the experience be multisensory, multimodal, I say, bringing to bear thoughts, feelings, sensations, intentions, actions, desires. The richer the experience, the more it's enriched. A fourth factor of enriching is novelty. The brain is a big novelty detector. As our ancestors moved around back in the Stone Age, what's the news? What's the new thing I need to pay attention to? So if we bring a sense of childlike interest or curiosity, or as the saying has it, Zen mind, beginner's mind, a quality of beginner's mind to the experiences we're having, then that will naturally intensify them in terms of their internalization. And then the fifth factor of enriching, one that I find personally really useful, is to focus on what's relevant, what's meaningful for you or salient in the experience you're having. The brain is designed to learn from the experiences that the animal, in this case us, considers to be relevant. So for example, why might it be particularly relevant today to really register that it goes better with your partner if you lean into a tricky interaction than lean away and search for the remote control for the television? Or why might it be meaningful or relevant for you today to really pay attention to an opportunity to feel seen or respected by another person, particularly given a childhood, perhaps, or earlier in adulthood, in which you were left out, dismissed, or devalued? Focusing on the personal relevance of an experience will really help it land. And then, moving on to absorbing, it's like that green ball, as it were, or the experience, as it were, that's moved through the bottleneck of the brain and coming into us is now coming in and sinking in and sticking to our mental ribs. There are three ways you can help an experience be absorbed. In other words, three ways you can sensitize and turbocharge the memory-making machinery of the brain. The first is simple. Intend to receive it into yourself. For many people, that's a critical first step because there's something that makes them uncomfortable about actually sustaining an experience of gratitude or sustaining an experience of feeling close to or affectionate with another person. There's something hard about that. Maybe they feel they don't deserve it. Maybe they're worried that if they pay attention to an experience that's beneficial over the course of a single breath, they'll lower their guard and that's when the world will get them. Understandable. And still, not really true. We can stay with, we can be with our beneficial experiences, and we can intend to receive them in ways that are private. The world doesn't need to know we're doing it. And in the process of doing this, grow strengths inside for dealing with the bad things. We can be both vigilant and aware of what's happening around us, while simultaneously, on the inside out, receiving into ourselves whatever is beneficial that we judge is beneficial in the present moment. So that's intending. A second factor that turbocharges the memory-making machinery of the brain is to sense in the body that the experience is sinking in. Technically, that tends to engage a part of the brain called the insula on the inside of the temporal lobes, two of them, like most of what's in the brain, kind of like Noah's Ark. There's two of almost everything in the brain. And if there's only one of something in the brain, that means that it's really old and really fundamental in terms of the evolution of the brain, such as there's only one hypothalamus. So if we tune into or sense into the experience, we engage the insula. The insula is very involved in what's called interoception, gut, including gut feelings, and it's very involved with the sense of who we are becoming. So engaging the insula by sensing the experience coming in gets involved, and that tends to increase the memory traces, the neural traces that are left behind. And a third way, last, to increase absorbing is to focus on what's rewarding about the experience, what's enjoyable about it or meaningful about it. In so doing, that will tend to increase the activity of dopamine and norepinephrine, two important neurotransmitter systems that are involved with the tracking of reward. And as dopamine and norepinephrine activity increase in the hippocampus, which is the front end of a lot of internalization of beneficial experiences, as dopamine and norepinephrine activity increase in the hippocampus, that flags the experience we're having at the time as a keeper and prioritizes it for protection during processes of long-term storage that can last hours and days and even weeks. So in these three different kinds of ways, and any one of them is good, the more the better, you can increase the sensitivity of the memory-making machinery of your brain. In effect, you can increase its capacity to absorb the experience in ways that leave lasting physical changes behind. This is the fundamental process of self-directed helping yourself to grow and learn and develop. I think of it a little bit like a fire. I've done a lot of camping. And step one, have the experience, have fire. Often, usually, because you notice it's already burning. Or, if need be, create the experience. Light the fire. Step two, enriching, protect the fire. Don't let other people rain on your parade. Watch that tendency in the mind to just click on to the next shiny object or chase the next worry. Stay with the beneficial experience. There's no exact right number. Probably at least a few seconds in a row are really important. I use the sense of staying with an experience over the duration of a breath or two or three, half a dozen, several dozen seconds. Just the more the better. But with the fire, as it were, watch the tendency to move away from the fire or let other people put it out. And even add fuel to the fire, enrich it further so it burns even more brightly. And then in the third step, absorb. We take the warmth of the fire into ourselves and receive it. That's the fundamental, necessary, and sufficient process of the neuropsychology of personal growth, personal healing, and change for the better. Additionally, in the HEAL acronym, there's a fourth step. I call it linking. This is the process in which we are aware of two things at once. Previously, I was only talking about beneficial experiences, most of which are enjoyable. Occasionally, there are beneficial experiences that are unpleasant or painful, such as healthy remorse or the sense of disenchantment, healthy disenchantment, where you realize that a particular job or a particular relationship is just not really going to work out. It's unpleasant, but it's important to take in. It's also true that some pleasant experiences are not so good for us, such as that first rush of anger or, you know, eating way too many cookies or having way too many drinks. That said, most beneficial experiences are actually enjoyable. They have a positive reward value. And that's because as our ancestors evolved, they evolved with Mother Nature's help, reward systems to mark and motivate those experiences, those states of being that were most useful for themselves and others of their kind for survival purposes and which helped grow resources over time also for survival purposes. So the enjoyability of an experience actually is typically a marker of its value. By the way, it's interesting that I think maybe in reaction to the field of positive psychology, we have these professional Grinches around who are saying, oh, happiness is fooling you and so forth. No, happiness is skillful means. The positive experiential quality, emotionally positive quality of the experiences is a marker in most cases that they're useful for us. They don't just feel good. They are good for us. So in that context then, I want to talk about linking, in which we're aware of something beneficial, something positive, quote-unquote, alongside, at the same time as some matched negative material. For example, we could be aware of an anxiety, a worry, while simultaneously drawing our attention to the resources we have to deal with that issue, drawing our attention to allies and others who are on our side and will help, maybe drawing our attention to a sense of calming in the body and the centering in a place of calm strength alongside that negative experience. And since neurons that fire together wire together through association, especially if the positive experience is bigger, it will gradually associate with and ease and calm and bring wisdom to and contextualize and even eventually replace that negative material. In effect, using my metaphor of the garden of the mind-brain system, we can use flowers to compensate for, crowd out, and even actually over time replace the weeds. This is the fundamental process of linking. It's natural to do it. Mindful awareness is itself a process of linking if what we're aware of is, quote-unquote, negative. painful or difficult or challenging. The spaciousness of open awareness is itself inherently untroubled. Trouble may pass through it, but awareness itself is never damaged or tainted or harmed by what it represents. In effect, awareness is like the sky, and the sky is never damaged or changed by the storm clouds passing through it. That right there is a kind of linking. Linking might sound fancy, but it's really natural. It's routine. If we talk ourselves off the ledge when we're getting really cranked up about something, that's a form of linking. Our daughter, when she was in middle school, who had a friend who said to her, "Laurel, remember your happy place." That is a form of linking. And we can do linking deliberately and effectively in the flow of everyday life. And one of the most powerful ways to do linking is to know what the red ball is. Know what your negative material is that you're grappling with. Maybe generally an anxious mood, or mildly depressed mood, or the residues of childhood and old feelings of inadequacy, or being left out, or not worth as much as other people, being less than other people. And then if you know what that negative material is, then everyday life gives you lots of wonderful opportunities to be mindful of ways in which you could have beneficial experiences that are usefully matched to the negative material, such as in my example of feeling left out and inadequate based on previous life experiences, looking for opportunities that are authentic, typically mild, but real. Not more than what they are, but not less than what they are. Looking for opportunities to have beneficial experiences, let's say, of worth. Being seen by others, being appreciated by others, others who are grateful, others who care about you, and also opportunities to feel and recognize your own good qualities, your own good intentions, your capabilities, and your own good heart. In effect, I'm talking here about really three things. See the good facts, the opportunities to have some kind of useful experience, but don't just see them, feel something. Often we see that someone has smiled. We see that we got something done, but it doesn't move the needle. We don't feel anything. See the good fact and let it become a good experience. I don't mean this morally, I mean it pragmatically, a beneficial experience. See the good fact, help it become a good experience, and then take that good into yourself. That's the fundamental process, and we can apply it to looking for the beneficial experiences that can help with our anxieties, our losses, our physical pains, the challenges around us, and the residues of our childhood. To summarize all this stuff in four direct and simple words, have it, enjoy it. In other words, have the beneficial experience, help that song play inside the inner iPod, and then enjoy it. Receive it into yourself, turn on the recorder, help the green balls, metaphorically, of beneficial experiences, enter into the bottleneck, and lodge in and stay in and last in your own nervous system. This is the essence of the process. And now, if you're up for it, I'd like to do something experiential with you. And you could think of this as a little kind of experiment inside the inner laboratory of your mind, which means inside the laboratory of your own brain. So I'll talk you through three different ways to take in the good here and engage the HEAL framework with three different kinds of experiences. I'll only focus on the first three steps because they're the necessary and sufficient steps, and I won't get into the linking step here. By the way, the linking step is optional because first, it's not necessary for change, and second, sometimes those negative experiences have a surprising power. They are like black holes inside our own mind, and they can just really suck us in. So if you do linking, it's really important to not be hijacked by the negative and to make sure that the positive experience is larger and more lasting. And if you do start getting sucked into the negative, if you try linking, just disengage from it. Reestablish the resource of the matched positive experience, and then, if you want, go back to the linking. And in this experiential practice, I won't do linking at all. Always know, as with anything I'm saying, including in this practice, feel free to ignore it. Go your own way. Adapt my suggestions for your own use. And if you'd like to stay with something a little longer than I'm doing here, you can do that. Or if you want to scoot ahead, you can do that as well. Here we go. So first, notice the fact that as you exhale, you naturally relax. That's because as we exhale, a part of the nervous system called the parasympathetic wing of the autonomic nervous system engages exhalation and naturally slows the rate of the heart beating. On the other hand, when we inhale, the sympathetic wing of the nervous system gets involved, which accelerates the rate of the heart beating. So there's a natural relaxation that occurs as we exhale. So I'll be quiet for a few moments here as I encourage you to start foregrounding in awareness. Start noticing what's already happening in the back of your awareness, that as you exhale, you slow down and calm and naturally relax. If you like, you could play with this a bit and naturally extend the length of the exhalation to give you more opportunities to be aware of the relaxation that comes with that. And as you start to have an experience of relaxing, let's move into installing this experience a little bit in your nervous system through enriching and absorbing it. Staying with the feeling of relaxing and, let's say, bringing awareness to it in your body as you relax here. As a kind of meditative practice, we're using the sense of relaxing as the object of attention upon which you are meditating. Also, often sort of mixed together with enriching, you can have a sense of absorbing. You can explore the sense of the relaxation kind of spreading in your body, making room for it. And you can be aware of some of what feels good about it, what's rewarding about it, as you focus now on absorbing relaxation into yourself. Okay. That was the first experiment, relaxation. In the flow of everyday life, most of the time when we take in the good, when we register beneficial experiences, it's quick. It's 10 seconds here, half a minute there. It's on the fly, all these different ways to turbocharge the growth process inside your own brain, kind of mushed together. But here, in this more formal teaching environment, I'm going to unpack these various methods, and we're going to focus on them in a slightly longer and more deliberate way. But just because that's how I'm doing it here doesn't mean that this is how to do it in the flow of everyday life. Okay, let's try the second little experiment here, experientially, and create a sense of gratitude or maybe gladness. So, if you will, bring to mind one or more things that you naturally and easily feel thankful for. It could be other people. It could be a simple thing like thankfulness for chocolate. It could be vast, such as thankfulness for life altogether. And as you start to recognize things to be thankful for, help that recognition become an experience of gratitude. Perhaps along with other related experiences such as gladness or happiness. And then, as you start to have an experience of gratitude, which might have a mainly conceptual dimension to it, and that's perfectly fine, the knowledge of things you've received, things you've been given that you're thankful for. As you have this experience, let's move into enriching and absorbing it so it can increase its likelihood of leaving a lasting trace behind. So with regard to enriching the experience of gratitude, keep it going. Try to get a sense in your own body of what it's like to be grateful. Stay with it. And And if you want, you can be aware of how gratitude is relevant to you. It's important to you for whatever reasons. This too is a factor of enriching. You can also absorb this experience with a sense of giving over to it, letting it land in you, sinking into gratitude as it sinks into you. You might have a sense of this experience really landing inside to help you develop what's called an attitude of gratitude, or more of an attitude of gratitude, to establish more trait gratitude inside you, letting it really land as you absorb it. Okay. That's the second experiment, and by the way, it's perfectly fine to continue to feel a little more relaxed or a little more grateful as we continue. And now I'd like to talk about the third experiment, third little practice here, of creating warm feelings for someone and then receiving these warm feelings and related feelings of caring or feeling liked yourself by this other person, letting them sink in. So bring to mind one or more beings that you care about. Could be a pet, could be a friend, a partner, a child, someone who's helped you, could be a group of friends. Bringing these beings to mind, and as you bring them to mind, help the knowing of them become an experience of warm caring, perhaps compassion, perhaps kindness, perhaps friendliness, perhaps love altogether. Helping yourself create an experience of warm feelings for someone here. And then as you start to have some sense here of warmth and caring, let's move into installation and internalize this experience. For example, if you want, you might enrich this experience in the factor I call multimodality. It just means to have it be more experiential with an action, such as putting your hand on your heart or getting a sense of what happens in your face as you bring to mind someone you care about. Taking warm feelings as your object of meditation, in effect, sort of marinating in a warmth, a caring, perhaps a lovingness. And you can also absorb this experience into yourself, letting it really spread inside, letting yourself have it. As you do this, other thoughts might arise, your mind might wander, that's really normal. Sometimes the opposite arises, like not feeling so caring or so cared about. That's okay too. Just come back to, rest attention on the primary thing, the primary experience you're wanting to take in this case, warm feelings for someone. You can also be aware of what feels good about warm-heartedness, which will help this experience sink in even more. That completes the third little practice here. And this experiential portion, it's okay to continue feeling, if you like, a little relaxed, a little grateful, and a little warm-hearted as we keep on going. And now I'd like to step back, if we can, and talk about the benefits that are available to us when we engage positive neuroplasticity in a deliberate way. The first kind of benefit is that we grow particular resources inside, resources such as relaxation and calm, or trait gratitude, or trait warm-heartedness and related qualities such as compassion or kindness or loyalty to other people. We can also grow specific resources, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, that are particularly matched to the issues that we've got. For example, if we tend toward anxiety, we can grow inner resources inside deliberately, such as calm strength, or the recognition that in most moments, we're actually basically all right. We may not have been basically all right in the past, we may not be basically all right in the future, but in this moment at least, we're basically all right. And we can also grow